Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Rick returns next Sunday. By now, pretty much every civilian has heard about the controversy over the statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. But behind the newspaper headlines, the statues have a rich and interesting history. Rick Britton is an historian of the Old Dominion who specializes in 18th and 19th century Virginia history. His expertise includes the American Civil War and the life and times of our third president, Thomas Jefferson. Along with his writing, Rick conducts tours of Civil War battlefields, teaches classes on the history of Central Virginia, organizes history programming for the center in Charlottesville, illustrates maps for history books, and lectures all across Virginia on a wide range of topics. With over 200 published articles and essays under his belt, he's the author of Albemarle and Charlottesville, An Illustrated History, and Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, for which he was awarded a medal for nonfiction at New York City's Book Expo, the nation's largest book convention. His newest book, Virginia Vignettes, Volume 1, Famous Characters and Events from Central Virginia History, is the first of a new series featuring some of the men and women who figure large in the 18th and 19th century American history. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I want to talk a little bit about your background. Were you always interested in history, or did this come later in life for you?
No, I was pretty much always interested in history. I was born in Richmond. I've lived all over the United States and in Latin America, but I've always been fascinated specifically by Virginia history. I was born in the early 50s, and so I was already reading quite a lot when the Civil War centennial came around, the 100th anniversary of the Civil War. Just prior to that, my grandmother in Richmond, my Britton grandmother, started buying me books about the American Civil War, and that was it. I got hooked, and I'm still reading books about the American Civil War.
So in your bio that I just read, I said historian, author, lecturer, but cartographer? How did cartography get tied into history? It's a very different skill.
It is a very different skill. We moved around a lot when I was little, and so I kept on reading. I kept to myself a lot. And in reading the history books, and back then it was almost all Civil War history books, that's really how I got started in history. I fell in love with the maps drawn back then, the maps illustrating those Civil War history books. So I started copying them. And at one point in high school, I remember my mom even complained that the walls of my room were just covered with these Civil War battle maps. And I still love maps. I didn't realize that at the time. What I was doing was I was training myself how to draw maps the way they were drawn 100, 200, 300 years ago. And so later on, when I helped found a publishing company, I was art director. I've always been a graphic designer. Myself and the president of the company, we illustrated most of the maps that were published. And then I kept that with me. When I left that company, I had a studio. I was able to get some contracts with some big publishing companies. And so to this day, it's a big part of my income is illustrating maps for history books. And the niche that I have is I use the pens. I use special mapping pens. I'm not drawing them with a computer program. So I can illustrate maps that look like maps from the Civil War and the American Revolution.
So do you use basically the same tools for drawing the maps that were used in the late 1800s?
Or? Basically, it's special mapping pens that the different nibs, the different pen points produce different line thicknesses, so I can, and that's important. You can't draw something and have all the lines be the same thickness. It's kind of boring for the eye.
Talk a little bit about your books. You're a successful published author, and in particular, talk about your most recent book.
Well, the latest book, I guess, is about 3 years old now, Virginia Vignettes. The idea was, and it's Central Virginia history, the idea was to talk about some of the most popular events and some of the most famous people, but also some people who are lesser known. One of my favorites, for example, there's an entire chapter on Benjamin Franklin Ficklin. Hardly anybody's heard of him. He was born here in the county, and became the founder, lived out west and got involved in shipping, and became the founder of the Pony Express. Hardly anybody knows that the founder of the Pony Express was born in Alamo County. He's buried in Maplewood Cemetery. And for a while, at the very end of the Civil War, he owned Monticello. He owned Thomas Jefferson's home. So to me, that's his story is just fascinating. So there's a lot of those. Some are pretty famous. Like, for example, there's an entire chapter on Dolly Madison. But I have some other ones on lesser known stories from this area, from Central Virginia.
And how do you go about researching your stories? If you were to use the internet, you would probably get as much wrong information as right information.
That's absolutely a
fact.
How do you
filter out the good from the bad?
Well, what you do is you try to find as much primary source information as you can, and primary means closest to the fact. So, for example, when you're writing about Dolly Madison, you want to find accounts written by people who actually visited and spent time with Dolly Madison. And you want to get the things that Dolly Madison wrote, the things that her husband wrote about her. So actually in writing, researching is almost half the fun. So I end up down at Alderman Library a lot, and I've got this huge backpack that can hold about 15 or 20 books. So I end up going down there and just, you know, piling on a whole bunch of books and coming home and finding the bits and pieces I want.
Are newspapers from that era, of the Civil War era, are they available on microfiche?
They are.
Can you actually look at source material like that?
Yeah, they are. So you can find those. And in some cases, books have been published that include some of the most important articles from back then. So yeah, newspaper articles are also primary source material. But as you can imagine, just like today, the newspapers back then were oftentimes wrong in what they published.
Of course.
Of course. There was fake news back then.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So, if you were a beginning student of history, you're a young person and you're interested in history, how would you get started? How could you become a Rick Britton 50 years from now? Oh, I just said something about your age. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Wow. The first thing that came to mind as you were asking that question was specializing, you know, find an area and become an expert on it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the history behind Civil War statues. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I understand you've been abroad recently.
Yeah.
You've taken your history abroad. Tell us about your most recent trip.
Well, working with the great folks at the travel office at the Senior Center, which is now the center. I'm having a hard time remembering that the Senior Center became the center. We put together a Thomas Jefferson in Paris trip. And so we organized it, we publicized it, and we did a lot of promotions over the course of a year. And we were able to get 17 people, and we took them over there. And in and around Paris, because, of course, we had to go to Versailles, which is outside of the city of Paris, we saw all the architectural gems that Jefferson fell in love with while he was there. So many of them still stand. And oh my gosh, Paris is probably, and I've been to a lot of different cities, the most beautiful city I've ever seen in my life. The historical section of Paris is just unbelievable. So we visited the neighborhoods where he lived. We saw the architectural gems. We went to Versailles. We went to the Louvre. We went to Notre Dame. And in the course of doing that, we were able to use a meeting room in the hotel, and I gave four lectures relating to Thomas Jefferson's time in Paris and in Europe while he was our minister of France between 1785 and 1789.
And where did you give these lectures on the street in front of the building, or did you have a venue?
No, we were able to use a meeting room at the hotel.
Oh, great.
So because we were filling so many rooms, we got this meeting room for free. So some of the evenings, and we were there for 7 evenings. 4 of those evenings, I gave lectures in the meeting room to our group.
Right. And how were you received by the French? Did you feel comfortable?
Oh my gosh! You know, I've heard the stories. A lot of people have heard the stories. My brother has told me some horrible stories. He studied in Brussels for a while. The French were just amazingly gracious. I mean, I encountered not one single rude French person. Not a waiter. Not a cab driver. Anybody, people on the subway, everybody was just amazing. And I read, though, I studied up a lot on Paris before we went, and I found that over the past decade or so, in Paris in particular, because it is the most visited city on the planet, over the past decade, they've made great efforts to, what they say, re-educate the people in Paris that they really ought to be nice to foreigners. Because people are coming and bringing money to their city, sure. And it's a huge industry in their city. Yeah.
Do the French, did you get a sense that the French, let me ask it this way, is Thomas Jefferson a part of French history in any way or sense?
He is a part of French history, and I was just really tickled to discover that when the people asked us what we were doing, and I told them, everybody knew who Thomas Jefferson was.
Really?
And of the people we encountered. Now, remember, we're going to all of the most touristy places in Paris. So we're encountering not just Parisians, but people from everywhere. I mean, from all over Europe and from North Africa. I mean, there were people from everywhere. It was really fantastic. Everybody knew who Thomas Jefferson was. And they had the people in Paris had a very favorable impression of Thomas Jefferson, which tickled me to no end. Yeah.
So how many people were on the tour again?
17 people total on the tour.
17 people. So describe a typical day on the tour. You get up, get people together.
Yeah.
So just pick a day that...
We'd head down to the breakfast room, and have our croissants and our brie. And I got totally addicted to having brie. I have to have brie for breakfast now. but my wife doesn't mind. She loves brie too. So what we did was I organized the tours around different themes relating to his time. So we actually hired a Parisian tour guide. He was fantastic. So typically on a day, we would meet our tour guide, Antoine, in our bus, his bus. And he would take us to the places that I had already designated from here in Charlottesville, Virginia, having never been to Paris. But then we would come back for lunch, and then there would be a tour in the afternoon just for us without our tour guide that my wife, Victoria, helped me put together. So we went to see some of the other places because there are so many amazing places to see in Paris. So a typical day would be half the day with Antoine and the other half day on something that my wife and I had organized, where we would get on the subway, and our hotel was very conveniently located right at a subway station. Get on the subway, go to a place and tour Notre Dame, Sainte-Chapelle, the Louvre, the Musée d'Orsay. We just had the most amazing time.
Wow, it's a playground for historians.
It's just a fantastic place, and I'm desperately trying to figure out how to get back there.
So you think there's another tour?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to do one in 2020. Out of Paris, we're going to do Normandy, but then we're also going to do some of the battles nearby from World War I. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the Central Virginians who fought in the World War I battles and the Central Virginians who fought at Normandy.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Great.
You should come. you and your wife should join us.
Maybe we will.
That would be great.
Rick Britton here, local historian Rick Britton. Let's get into the meat of why you're here.
Okay.
We're gonna talk about the Civil War statues in Charlottesville from the perspective of a historian.
Right.
Many people think or believe that the statues were built during the Civil War.
Or immediately after the Civil War.
Or immediately after the Civil War. True or false?
No, well, that's false, of course. And there's lots of reasons. One of the reasons, of course, is the South was devastated by the loss in the Civil War, economically, financially, culturally. The South was turned upside down. There are actually four Civil War statues in and around Charlottesville. When people talk about the Civil War statues, though, typically they focus on the Robert E. Lee statue and the Stonewall Jackson statue. They both went up in the 1920s, the Stonewall Jackson in 1921, the Robert E. Lee in 1924. There are two other statues, both of private soldiers. One is in front of the courthouse, and that one went up in 1909. So that's in front of the Albemarle County Courthouse. So technically, it's on Albemarle County property. It's not really on city property. The other one, which is probably just about the most beautiful artistically, is at the Civil War Cemetery that's alongside the University of Virginia Cemetery. And that one went up in the 1880s. But typically, when people think about the Charlottesville Civil War statues, they're talking about Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, right?
Right. Can you give us a sort of a 10,000 feet view of these two men, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson? We're going to talk in a lot more detail about these men later, but can you just give us a feeling for who these men were?
Sure. So they are two, from a Virginian's point of view, and I'm a Virginian born in Richmond, two of the greatest Confederate heroes during the Civil War. Both brilliant military men. The two of them together pulled off some amazing defeats. And when I say amazing, I'm thinking of the Battle of Chancellorsville, where Lee and Jackson together defeated a Union army that was about twice the size of the forces they commanded. The two of them worked together because they were both really aggressive. So from the point of view of military history, these men, Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, I would not hesitate to rank with the greatest military leaders our nation has produced. George Washington, Patton, Eisenhower, Marshall. I would put them in the same category as those men. The thing is, though, that's looking at them from a military point of view. And military history is just a small slice of history. Growing up, to me, Civil War history was everything. History, all history, was Civil War history. So I had initially a very, very narrow view of history. You know, and later on, as I became a writer and I'd pitch my history stories, I was surprised to discover that there are historians that study the history of shopping centers in America. And I remember my first reaction was, that's not history. Well, of course it's history. There's all kinds of history. So it's possible to revere these men as great military leaders through the lens of military history. And again, that's a small slice of history. Then you step back, and this is the reason I'm saying this, as you said, the 10,000-foot view. You step back and look at them through the lens of social history, and you have to acknowledge that what they fought for was wrong and a great evil, and one of the greatest evils our country has had, the institution of slavery.
So what you're saying is essentially you can have two views of these men. You can you can view them as military leaders, and then you can also view them. You don't have to really pick one or the other. You can view them in two different lenses, essentially.
And I give a lot of Civil War history tours in the local area, and I talk about this all the time, and people ask, and they want to see the statues, and they also want to see where the riot took place, and they want to understand why and how that happened.
Sure.
They want to see that. Visitors to our town want to see that, and they want to try to understand that. It's not just people here in Charlottesville that are grappling with that issue. Our visitors are too.
And does that become a part of the history of these two men as well?
It does.
Does it?
It absolutely does.
It's part of their legacy.
It is.
In a sense, right?
It absolutely is.
In a real sense.
I think it really is.
Yeah.
The people are asking me to tell them the story. How did this happen? Where did it happen? And how did it happen?
Right. Because it happened last year or a little bit more than a year ago doesn't mean it's not history.
Right.
Right. And it also doesn't mean it's not part of the history of these men.
Exactly. It's tied directly to those statues.
Yeah. Right. Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the history behind Charlottesville's Civil War statues. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. After the break, more on Charlottesville statues and the men they memorialize. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with historian Rick Britton here at 94.7 WPVC, and we're talking about the history of Charlottesville's Civil War statues. Want to talk about, go back to the Civil War a little bit and paint a little background here before we get to talk more about the men. There seems to be some disagreement with some people about what the Civil War was about. Was it about states' rights or was it about slavery?
The way that I parse it with my visitors when I'm giving tours is that it's very frustrating to me, and I'm fascinated by this topic, but it's very frustrating that a lot of Americans seem to believe that there is a disagreement, that there's some kind of debate over what the war was fought over. There's no debate among historians. One of my favorite Civil War historians who just retired from the University of Virginia, Gary Gallagher, put it really well one time humorously on a television show. And a friend of mine who had a local show asked him, so what do you tell people who say that it was about states' rights? And he actually laughed. And he said, you can believe that the Civil War was fought over states' rights if you don't read. It's pretty simple. If you read the documents from back then, if you read the primary source materials from back then, what the men in the South said they were fighting the war over, what they published, what they said, there's no question. They knew back then that they were fighting the war over the institution of slavery. Their intent on leaving the Federal Union was to protect the right of the citizens of their states to own fellow human beings as slaves. All you have to do is Google the phrase ordinances of secession. Each one of the 11 states, Confederate states, as they were leaving the Federal Union, they voted on, passed, and published what's called an ordinance of secession. You can Google it and read all of them, and they will tell you exactly why they're leaving the Federal Union. And it's slavery, slavery, slavery. What's even fascinating is you don't even have to read very far, and you see how they refer to the northern states. Oftentimes, they call them the non-slaveholding states.
Right.
It's all about slavery.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Was there the concept of white supremacy at this time, or is that a more modern terminology viewpoint?
You know, the way to go at that would be to Google the term and see when it was first used. My sense is that term is more modern. But of course, white supremacy existed. I mean, slavery is probably the worst manifestation of white supremacy. Enslaving Africans and African Americans obviously is white supremacy, of course.
I'm wondering about Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Order,
Proclamation, right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
It didn't come right at the beginning of the Civil War, did it?
Right. And a lot of people are confused about a lot of things. But basically, the simple way I answer that question is this. 11 southern states seceded from the Federal Union, but there were 4 more states that were slave states, that we call them now border states, that did not secede: Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. At the very beginning of the war, Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln, could not make the war over slavery. He could not say it was over slavery. He would risk losing 4 more states to the Southern Confederacy. And when you think about it, if you think of the location of Washington, D.C., the federal capital, once Virginia secedes, an entire border of Washington, D.C. is a slave state. Imagine where Washington, D.C. would be if Maryland had seceded. Washington would have been completely surrounded by enemy territory. So he's running the risk early on of losing four more states if he tries to make the war about slavery. So initially, he makes the war about the Union. He tries to, his stated cause is to bring the erring sister states, that's what he liked to call the southern states,
right,
back into the fold, back into the federal Union. Eventually, though, he needs some victories, and eventually he gets a victory at Sharpsburg. We call it Sharpsburg in the South. In the North, they call it Antietam in Maryland. And he believes he has the momentum in the war to issue the Emancipation Proclamation.
And what happens immediately after that? When after the proclamation is issued, does the war become more vicious?
Eventually, it becomes more vicious. Yeah. Initially, and it's another confusing aspect about the Emancipation Proclamation is it doesn't free. It only frees slaves that are still in Confederate territory. So slaves that are in Northern territory or in areas that have been conquered by the Union armies were not freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. So the best way to look at it is as a War Powers Act of the president. The rules, the laws regarding slavery were different state by state. So this is why Lincoln at the beginning of the war says that he has no constitutional authority to end slavery in the states. And he's right, because slavery is written in to the U.S. Constitution. It's in the Constitution, even though they're not mentioned. They're not called slaves in the Constitution, but it's written into the Constitution. He doesn't feel like he has any authority to end slavery in the separate Confederate states. But one of the things that's really fascinating is slavery still exists in the Constitution regarding federal prisoners. So the federal prison system is still allowed to use people as slaves to produce merchandise for sale.
Wow. And obviously not illegal.
Right.
Historian Rick Britton, in our Hillsdale Drive studio this morning, we're talking about the history behind Charlottesville's Civil War statues. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I want to talk a little bit about the Jim Crow South leading up to the statues and when the statues were built and dedicated.
Yep.
First of all, who was Jim Crow, briefly?
So Jim Crow is a caricature. There was a minstrel performer by the name of Thomas Dartmouth Rice, who became fairly popular in the 1830s, and the different dictionaries agree on this. The first time the term Jim Crow was coined was 1838. So there's even a song about Jim Crow. So imagine the nastiest, stereotypical African-American caricature, and I think it's okay to use the word step and fetch it, and it's offensive, but that's that character. He performed in blackface, derisively singing about these stereotypical African Americans. So it originates way back then. But the Jim Crow era really begins at the end of Reconstruction. Reconstruction was the occupation of the South by military forces from the end of the Civil War, 1865, to 1877, when the northern troops, were removed from the southern states and they were pretty much returned. The southern legislatures almost immediately began passing these segregationist laws. So states and localities started passing these laws, the idea being to take rights away from this whole race of people who had just recently been freed at the end of the American Civil War and return them to a condition that's as close back to slavery as they possibly can.
Without actually being slaves.
Without actually being slaves. Right.
So this is a series of when we talk about the Jim Crow era, it's a series of enacted laws.
Right.
And practices.
Right.
Basically intended to return African Americans back to the state of slavery.
To segregate the races.
Sure.
And so it's amazing, you know, I knew of a few of the things, of the few of the categories where the races were segregated. I mean, heck, I remember some of them. I'm that old, but it's incredible. I mean, restrooms, of course, were segregated. Lunch counters. Everybody knows about lunch counters.
Right, sure.
Water fountains. I seem to remember seeing a whites-only water fountain when I was a little kid.
In Richmond?
In Richmond.
Right.
Elevators. I didn't know about elevators. I looked this up just a couple of days ago. Elevators were segregated in some places. Cemeteries. Cemeteries had already been segregated, but they passed laws in some states to segregate them permanently. And then, of course, possibly the worst instance, schools were segregated.
Right.
And then this was actually okayed by that famous case that made it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And everybody knows about this. You're going to recognize this phrase in just a moment. It was in 1896, and it's the famous Plessy v. Ferguson case. And the ruling was that it was okay if they were separate but equal. So it was okay to segregate the schools, says the Supreme Court, because they're going to be separate, and that's okay as long as they're equal. The problem is they were never equal. They were never equal.
Right.
And one of the big problems in our country, I think, to this day, is the school systems largely are funded by real estate taxes. So think about this for a moment. That means the poorer districts get poorer schools.
Sure.
They can't afford to pay their teachers.
Right.
They can't afford to have nice buildings. They can't afford to keep them as clean. Poor places get less good schools, and the rich areas get really nice schools with well-paid teachers.
I want to move on now to the statues themselves.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about them. Let's start with the Robert E. Lee statue.
Uh-huh.
Tell us about it. It was originally commissioned by Paul McIntyre.
Yeah. So one of the great benefactors here in Charlottesville and at the University of Virginia, as well, as Paul Goodloe McIntyre. So he was born in 1860 here in Charlottesville. So he actually witnessed the capture of Charlottesville right at the end of the American Civil War in early March of 1865. He was 5 years old when the city was captured by a cavalry army under Philip Sheridan, who encamped really close to Paul Goodloe McIntyre's home on Park Street. So he attended the University of Virginia, but the family didn't have enough money. University of Virginia was always very, very expensive, not so much anymore, but was very, very expensive back then. So he has to go to work. So he goes to Chicago, gets into the coffee exchange, makes a lot of money, and then gets a position at the New York Stock Exchange, becomes a multimillionaire, and by the 19-teens, comes back to Charlottesville and literally starts giving it all away to his hometown. So because he had so much money, he could actually go to New York to the National Sculpture Society and hire world-class sculptors. So, for example, with the Stonewall Jackson Memorial, that was the original formal name of it, with the Stonewall Jackson Memorial, there was a little row of African-American housing that was right there called the, it just slipped right out of my head. That area was bought up. The houses were torn down to make space for the park. Then he commissioned for Stonewall Jackson, he commissioned Charles Keck, who's just a fabulous sculptor. Charles Keck also produced for McIntyre the Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea statue that's right there on West Main Street in Ridge McIntyre. Schrady sculpted Robert E. Lee in a style that I would call monumental. It's way larger than life. The horse is not Traveler, his war horse. It's a draft horse that would hold a Teutonic knight. Robert E. Lee is just massive on the horse. I mean, you can recognize that it's Lee immediately, but he's, you know, way, way, way built. I call that the monumental style. I think the Stonewall Jackson statue is much, much nicer artistically.
We need to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the Robert E. Lee statue, and we'll talk about the Stonewall Jackson statue. Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the history behind Charlottesville's Civil War statues. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stream us online at 94.7WPVC.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. After the break, more on Charlottesville's statues and the men they memorialize. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. Back in action here with historian Rick Britton in our studios talking about the statues, the Civil War statues, the history of the Civil War statues here in Charlottesville. Rick, I kind of cut you off there. We were talking about the Robert E. Lee statue.
Right.
And we were talking a little bit about Schrady, but Schrady didn't finish the statue, I understand.
That's right. So an Italian sculptor, Leo Lentelli, came in and completed it for him. It was an interesting controversy when the whole thing with the city council was going on and they were considering voting to sell the statues. You know, there's still an ongoing lawsuit about that. But one of the city councilors kept posting that in photographs of the dedication of the Robert E. Lee statue in 1924, that you could see Klansmen in the audience wearing their robes and hoods. And, you know, this had come up years and years ago because they're, you know, they're photographs from both of those dedications, the dedication of the Jackson in 21 and the dedication of the Lee Monument in 24. And so this had been resolved a long time ago. So I went on Facebook and I challenged the city councilor, and I was able to produce photographs to prove that what the councilor was saying was wrong. You know, facts are really important. They weren't the robes of Ku Klux Klansmen. And it's important to note that I'm not saying that Ku Klux Klansmen weren't present at the dedication. I'm sure there were probably Klansmen in the audience. They just weren't wearing their robes. They weren't in their official Klan regalia. Even in 1924, that would have been a little bit much. What they were, these white billowy things, it's kind of interesting, and people had a hard time believing me at first until I produced photographs. One of the units that was present at the dedication was the Richmond Light Infantry Blues. My dad was a member of the Richmond Light Infantry Blues. Their dress uniform is, I think, still to this day, a War of 1812 era uniform, reproduction uniform, with a shako, and a shako is a tall cap with feathery plumes on top of it.
Right.
And in the photograph, with all of them standing together in double ranks, it does look sort of like billowy, you know, robes, but it was the feathered plumes on the top of the shakos of the Richmond Light Infantry Blues. So I thought that was a fascinating story about the dedication.
Interesting. Really, really, really interesting. Let's move on to Stonewall. That's not his real name, right?
No.
Of course not.
No, his name is Thomas Jonathan Jackson.
Right. So the Stonewall Jackson statue, did that come after the Lee statue?
No, the Stonewall Jackson statue was actually dedicated first in 21, and the Robert E. Lee statue was dedicated in 24. I've got that correct, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's correct. So it actually went up first.
And it was also funded by
Paul Goodloe McIntyre.
Goodloe McIntyre, right? And sculpted by Charles Keck.
Charles Keck.
Do we know anything about him?
A fantastic sculptor. He produced a lot of statues of military themes. Here in town, as I mentioned earlier, he also produced the Lewis and Clark, which I think is beautiful. Also controversial, by the way, because Sacagawea is crouching by the two men. And so feminists disapprove of that statue. And recently there was a plaque attached. I don't know the wording on that one. But there was a plaque attached to talk more about Sacagawea to give her her due. Well, Stonewall Jackson, amazingly popular man during the American Civil War. He was accidentally mortally wounded by his own men at the Battle of Chancellorsville in early May of 1863. But for a large part of the American Civil War, and I think some of your listeners might find this surprising, Stonewall Jackson was actually more famous than Robert E. Lee. He had won some early victories, especially his Valley campaign in the spring of 1862, just as Robert E. Lee is taking over command of the Army of Northern Virginia, the main Confederate army operating in the state of Virginia. Stonewall Jackson conducted a campaign that liberated the Shenandoah Valley just to the west of us, 25 miles to the west of us, from Union forces that totaled 2.5-3 times the numbers that he had. And he did it with rapid maneuver, surprising his enemies at how fast he could move his small force of about 16,000-17,000 men. Rapid maneuver, lightning strikes, and a lot of guts. Remember I said earlier that he and Robert E. Lee were alike in that they were both very, very aggressive on campaign and on the battlefield. So Stonewall Jackson and the Shenandoah Valley put the fear of God in the Lincoln administration. When you think of the, if you can imagine the geography of Virginia, the Shenandoah Valley runs from southwest to northeast. It's on an odd angle. A Confederate army in the Shenandoah Valley, as it moves northeast down the Shenandoah Valley, it actually gets closer and closer to the federal capital. So the Shenandoah Valley forms a perfect avenue of approach to get to the back door of Washington, D.C. So his successful Valley campaign put the fear of God in the Abraham Lincoln administration.
And were Jackson and Lee contemporaries rank-wise in the Army, or was...
No. So Lee outranks Stonewall Jackson, and when Lee takes over command of the Army of Northern Virginia, he calls Jackson and his Valley Army to him, and the two of them together defend Richmond against a much larger Union army against George, commanded by George Brinton McClellan. So Robert E. Lee was a general, and at the very end of the war became general of the armies. So he commanded all of the Confederate armies all across what remained of the Confederate States right at the very end of the Civil War. Stonewall Jackson was his probably most famous lieutenant as a lieutenant general, commanded one of the corps. So during the time that they operated together, as I mentioned, Stonewall Jackson was accidentally mortally wounded in 1863. During the little over a year that they operated together, Stonewall Jackson commanded a corps, half of Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. He commanded the Second Corps. The First Corps was commanded by James Longstreet, another lieutenant general.
So were these two statues the obvious choice of the... I mean, are these considered to be... Lee and Jackson considered to be the greatest... I don't want to use the word heroes. I don't think that's appropriate.
Well, when we talk militarily, famous military leaders, successful military men, remember, we're not talking about the cause that they fought for, but just from a military point of view, I think it's possible to say that that they were great military men. Yeah, they're obvious choices, and it's kind of interesting, and it's been interesting to me to see this whole debate and the argument and the god-awful riots that we had and the senseless loss of life and people being injured. It was just really horrific what happened to our little town. But it's interesting to hear people talk about how there's no connection between these men and Charlottesville. And obviously that's just not true. Right. I've heard city councilors say that over and over and over again. That's just not true. Hundreds of men and boys from Charlottesville and Albemarle County fought underneath those two men. There were, specifically, I can give you one unit, the Charlottesville Artillery, that included a number of students from the University of Virginia, fought under Stonewall Jackson's command in the Shenandoah Valley. That's just one unit. But literally hundreds and hundreds. And everyone in Virginia at one time or another would be under Robert E. Lee's command in the Army of Northern Virginia. So at the time when these statues went up, there were still surviving veterans of the war who had served under those two men. Beyond that, Robert E. Lee, at the outbreak of the war, his youngest boy, Robert E. Lee Jr., was a student at the University of Virginia. So we know for a fact that Robert E. Lee came to UVA, Charlottesville and UVA, to visit his son at school. Stonewall Jackson, while he was teaching science and artillery tactics at VMI in Lexington in the Shenandoah Valley, applied for a position in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Virginia. So there's that other connection. He tried to get a position teaching at the University of Virginia. He heard that this post was open. He dusted off his resume, got on his horse, rode over the Shenandoah Valley, rode over the Blue Ridge Mountains, sat down for this interview, and didn't get the job. Stonewall Jackson was not a good enough professor to teach at Mr. Jefferson's University.
Historian Rick Britton here in our studio this morning. We're talking about the history behind Charlottesville's Civil War statues. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I want to talk a little bit about Paul Goodloe McIntyre. None of this would have happened, probably, had this gentleman not come along. What do we know? You talked a little bit about him earlier. He was a coffee merchant.
Yep, in Chicago, and then got a post on the New York Stock Exchange, became a multi-millionaire. I'm sure that at the time, he thought that he was doing just a brilliant thing for his hometown. You have to consider that both of those statues were put up on the edge of African-American neighborhoods. One of the things that's really interesting, and we have to be really careful about in these discussions of people in the past, you have to be careful with something that's known in history as presentism, and that is using our present-day morals and ethics to
and knowledge
to analyze people in the past. So I am sure, like, for example, the reason I'm thinking of this is I'm sure that we would discover that this man was a typical white person of his time and that his views were fairly racist. I'm sure we would discover that. But at the time, most every white person was. And so it's very difficult to parse these things and to try to keep them in a proper context.
I want to move on to a little bit more delicate topic now, and that is the representation of the statues as white supremacist icons for the white supremacist movement.
Yeah.
And I want to begin with a full disclosure by saying that neither Mr. Britton or myself are persons of color. So we don't feel the pain of white supremacy in the same way that people of color do.
Of course not.
Of course not.
Right.
I guess my first question is, when I asked you a little bit earlier about the term white supremacy going back to the Civil War, but in the 1920s when these statues were commissioned, was it considered to be an act of white supremacists at that time?
At the time?
Yeah, at the time.
No, at the time I don't think it was. No, of course not. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. even though, you know, the 1920s were what a lot of people consider to be the height of the Jim Crow era, or you could say the lowest point of the Jim Crow era, with lynchings going on all across the South, African American males being lynched. Over the length of the Jim Crow era from the 1880s into the 1950s, something like 3,400 African American males were lynched across the South. And when we say lynching, we mean an illegal hanging, someone who is hung without the benefit of a jury trial, without the benefit of the rights that that person's supposed to have as an American citizen. In the 1920s, that book, The Klansman, came out. The movie that was produced based on the movie The Klansman was, and the name of it just went from my head, but it was a much touted silent movie that portrays the Klan as the saviors of the South in their regalia, in their hoods and robes. It's a horrible time, for African Americans.
So, but from a historic perspective, we just can't pretend the Civil War didn't happen. We can't pretend that there was no slavery.
Right.
And yet, for many people of color, I believe these statues are very offensive.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So, is there a balance? I mean, is there a balance that we can find?
I think there is a balance. If this is what I tell the people ask me about this all the time, so I've had to think about these issues very carefully to figure out how to parse all of these things, because these are very delicate topics. If someone came to me and said, "You decide what's going to happen with the statues," I would keep the statues, but I would put up. It would take a kiosk. It would take a small lean-to to hold enough information to put everything into context like we're attempting to do right now. It would take a lot of information. But as an African-American friend of mine says, who teaches up at the University of Virginia, that's still not going to help an African-American family driving by in their car trying to decide if they want to move their family to Charlottesville, Virginia. That's not going to help them. Now, that being said, I think that eventually what will happen to all of these statues and memorials across the South, and I'm not saying I know how long this will take, I think eventually all of them will get moved. According to a recent study, there are about 1,500 of them. We're talking about statues, memorials, plaques, stones. I think that eventually all of these things will get moved, and I think that there are three better places for them. One would be Confederate cemeteries, where the men fought and died under these officers that we're talking about,
right?
Specifically Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Number two would be museums, where hopefully there would be a guide or a historian who could talk about these things in context and put all of this information in context for the viewer, for the visitor. My favorite place, though, I've saved for last, and I think this would be the absolute best place for our two statues here in Charlottesville, Virginia, and that would be Civil War battlefields, where, again, there would be a guide, a historian, a park ranger, who would be putting all of this information into context, talking about slavery as the main precipitating cause of the American Civil War, answering questions. People ask me all the time, people want to debate with me while I'm giving the tour. Oh, no, what, it was about states' rights. I have to explain these things to people. There'd be somebody that would explain all of this complicated information and fascinating information to people about our history and about this sad time in American history.
Are there any other cities that have tried this? Gettysburg comes to mind, where you've got statues in a setting.
Yeah, but that's the park. That's a battlefield.
Right, it's a battlefield.
So,
right.
So you know, when the whole situation with the massacre in Charleston and then the statue situation came up, I remember they were the superintendent up there at Gettysburg said that people were writing him and asking him if he was going to take his statues, and he said unequivocally, no, absolutely not. This is the right place for the statues, and I agree with him. Civil War battlefields are the right place for Confederate statues.
That's right, because it sets them in a military context.
Exactly.
That we were talking about earlier.
Exactly right. Exactly right. But other cities have taken them down. In Baltimore, statues have come down. In New Orleans, they took the statues, four Civil War statues down in the middle of the night, if I remember correctly. And other places are talking about them. Here locally in Virginia, David Toscano the other day introduced a bill that would allow localities to decide for themselves what they want to do with their statues. One of the problems here in Virginia is there is a state law, a state statute, that prohibits localities from doing anything with a war memorial. So it really does seem that, like, when the city councilors here in Charlottesville voted to sell the statues and move them, it was illegal what they did. They didn't have the right to vote them. They didn't have the right to sell the statues or move them or touch them. In order to do that, we have to go to the legislature and get that law overturned or altered or amended. And so David Toscano has introduced that. I think that's a good way to get started. And when you think about it, different localities, why shouldn't different localities have the right to do that? Like, for example, Lexington. Both of these men, Lee and Jackson, are buried in Lexington, Virginia. So perhaps Lexington would want to keep Confederate statues. But here in Charlottesville, it's a much more left-leaning town. Charlottesville doesn't seem to want to keep its statues. So why shouldn't Charlottesville be able to remove its statues?
Just a minute or so left. We got to wind up. Time has gone by so fast.
Wow.
It's been fascinating.
It's been a lot of fun.
Listening to you. What have you got coming up? Historian Rick Britton, what have you got coming up? more tours, more lectures. What's happening in your world?
Yeah, I've got classes, a class at the Senior Center that starts, the center in Charlottesville, that starts in March. It's Albemarle's Early Days, where I'll be giving a couple of talks, but I'll be bringing in some other historians to talk about the early history of Albemarle County. And I'll be putting together for the center for late September of this year, I'm putting together a Revolutionary War trip for 4 or 5 days to Philadelphia. There are so many Revolutionary War-related sites in and around Philadelphia, including Valley Forge, a number of battlefields, Brandywine, Germantown. It's just going to be a fantastic trip.
Cool. And if somebody wants to learn more about Rick Britton or wants to commission one of your fine maps, how would they get in touch with
you? They can find me online at www.rickbritton.com.
Right. And the center, I said it too, the Senior Center.
I know.
The center in Charlottesville.
Right.
Do they have information on your tours?
They do.
They
classes? Do. They have information on that class I mentioned, and I'm pretty sure it's www.thecenter.org.
All right.
It's their website.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Will you come back and see us another time?
I'd love to.
All right. Historian Rick Britton in our studio this morning. We have been talking about the history behind Charlottesville's Civil War statues. This and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when Rick Moore returns to the anchor chair with Shawnell Sen, a research and policy analyst at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. They will be discussing youth, family, and employment. Coming up at noon on 94.7 WPVC, it's El Club del Sabor. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC. We'll be right back.